Tunnel vision, peripheral vision. This is Dr. Herbert L. Byerly, Dean of the University of Healing here in Campo, California, with instant illumination. Tunnel vision or peripheral vision. We go through life most of the time with tunnel vision. We just see straight ahead. We don't see all of the things that are around us. We don't see all the things that make up our world. And we wonder why our world is so limited, why our world is so uninteresting, why our world is so one-directed. Well, to be one-pointed is a very admirable thing. To be one-pointed is something that we teach very strongly here at the University of Healing. But to be one-pointed in the allness is how we would like to have you be. Now, how can you be one-pointed in the allness? How can you be one-pointed as aware of everything that's going on around you? As people age, the tendency is to close down on their area of vision. They feel their body is unstable. They feel that their ability to comprehend is limited, and they feel that all these things are not too pleasant for them. Now, when a baby is born, a baby is sort of has a built-in radar, and it can follow things around a room. It can follow a toy that's being moved, or a person's face, or something that interests him. And it develops this tunnel vision to be its advantage, because it can find the nipple, it can find its food, it can find the things that are important for its survival. And that's a very wonderful thing. But as the baby grows, and as their field of vision grows, they begin seeing more and more things. Their peripheral vision grows and expands to include all the world around them. And they take it all in. They take it in carefully and digest it. They don't necessarily take it all in at once, but they know it's there and they travel beautifully. The peripheral vision now has expanded to a wonderful degree. And as we go through life, we use this peripheral vision as we're driving, as we're walking, as we're surviving. As man was surviving in the jungles and in the difficult times of the early man's creation, he was unable to have the freedom of being one-pointed or tunnel vision, because if he wasn't aware of some creature coming along trying to devour him, he would be devoured and he would not be around anymore. So a certain peripheral vision was developed out of necessity. And as people aged, the community and the family and others took care of them, and so they didn't need to be aware of what was going on all around them. They didn't have to have that suspicious attitude which apparently comes when we are aware by looking all around us. But a child's peripheral vision is developed not so much by moving its eyes around looking at things, which it did in the early stage, but moving the ability in its vision to be aware of things at the extremities of its eyes' focusing area. Now, when we can train ourselves to have a good peripheral vision, which we always have had, and which when our eyes were younger, they were very flexible and very harmonious and had excellent peripheral vision. We could put both hands out to the sides of our head and out straight out from our ears, and we could see them easily. And then as we move them further back, as we develop that ability to see more and more, deeper and deeper, more and more, beautiful things happen to us because we were taking in a larger field of vision. we were seeing the widescreen. And seeing the widescreen was a very exciting adventure. Many people watching widescreen television or widescreen movies cannot take in the entire screen of the movie by looking straight ahead. They have to look hither and yon to see what's going on there. But young, facile, beautiful, flexible eyes, eyes of youth, eyes of magic, these eyes can see all of these things perfectly, beautifully, and wonderfully. These are the kind of eyes that each one of us would like to have. We'd like to have the ability to see the wide screen of life. We'd like to have the ability to see in a greater focal point of view. Now, I suggest that this can be done quite easily as we train ourselves in many other ways. The medical community tells us that tension and anxiety are the greatest killers on the face of the earth. Tension and anxiety. Well, where does tension and anxiety come from? Tension and anxiety come from our own lack of awareness of what's going on in our world, our own lack of awareness of the peace that we live in, our own lack of peripheral vision. Now, I recommend to the students of the University of Healing that each one of them put their fingers in front and then slowly move both fingers from dead center in front to as far out on each side as they can, keeping their eyes looking dead center front, but moving their fingers away, away, away. Now, I'm blessed in being able to see straight out to the edge of my ears while looking straight ahead and know what's going on out there and know what is happening out there, but yet looking straight ahead. Now, as I do this, I don't do this straining anything. I just relax my eyes. And as I relax my eyes are able to see beautifully and harmoniously and wonderfully, and I'm able to just see more than that. I can read without glasses when I relax. When I just relax my eyes and I am at peace, when I let the anxieties and the tensions go, then all of the pressure is gone and all of the strain is gone from my head, from my eyes, from my ears, from my nose, from everything about me, and things fall into place. The exercise of moving your fingers from dead center to the farthest reaches that you can see without moving your eyes from dead center, as you move your fingers out, and you look and you see the past to the edges of your ears. You see with a greater depth of field and a greater peripheral vision than you ever believed possible. But most of this peripheral vision comes not because our eyes have the ability to see, but because our eyes are relaxed and our eyes are at peace. And as our eyes are at peace, the vision of our eyes becomes into a second stage, you might say. The first stage is where we see normal things and we read and we write and we are aware. The second stage is when we see without looking. When we see, when we open our eyes and we look around us, and then we close our eyes, and we still see what we saw when our eyes were open. Now, you say, well, that's just sort of a memory activity going on. Yes, it is of a nature. But what it is, it's an implant of things that are actually going on in our brain, things that are actually going on in our mind. We can actually see them. Now, I was looking out the window here just now, and as I looked out the window, something flashed into the periphery of my eye on the right side. And I didn't look at it because I am training myself now not to look at it, but yet I looked at it while keeping my eyes straight ahead, and I could see that it was a bird fluttering along. And then the bird chose to land right in the center of my center vision. And it was some 50 feet away. And as the bird landed, it moved its head from side to side, and it looked at me, and it says, "Okay, you got the message?" And I thought to myself, "Now, just a minute. What's going on here?" Well, what's going on here is the idea that we all have this wonderful capacity at marvelous peripheral vision. But unfortunately, we do not pressure ourselves to go there. Now, pressure seems like anxiety and tension, and it can be anxiety and tension. But to pressure ourselves means to be aware. Now, please say to your sister, "I love you." I won't. Say to your sister, "I love you." I won't. Now tell your sister she's a wonderful girl, and that I love you. I won't. Now, your sister has a gift for you, and she will give it to you as soon as you say, "I love you." And so immediately you say, "I love you. I love you, sis. I love you." And then you get the gift, and you think to yourself, that wasn't so bad. Maybe if I say, "I love you," more often, I'll have happy times. Not necessarily always gifts, but I'll have happy times. I'll have a happy relationship here. I'll have something beautiful going on. And you see, as we are pressured into doing something one time, and the reward is beneficial, we sometimes begin to equate that into other areas. And we can very readily equate that into other areas. And as we equate that into other areas, beautiful things happen to us. Beautiful doors open for us, and beautiful experiences come into our life. I cannot emphasize too strongly the value of peripheral vision. And I would recommend each one of us, if we could take just a moment or two every day, first thing when we get up in the morning perhaps, and just either lie there in bed and move our arms from side to side, or sit up or stand up or whatever we do. But take a few moments and move our hands as we sit there from one side to the other. We take our fingers and we put them in the middle of our vision, and then we continue looking straight ahead. And we move our fingers out to the peripheral vision, where our fingers cannot normally be seen. And at first, we may only work into a 60-degree angle from dead center. But as we continue to work, we'll find that we can go to 90 degrees. And then we'll find that we can go to 95 and 100 degrees. And pretty soon, we'll find that we can do some pretty marvelous things. 90 degrees is sufficient. Going 90 degrees is a wonderful step. But going the extra steps is just to show us that our vision is not always in the lens of our eye, but is in the lens of our mind. And the lens of our mind works in a very peaceful, joyful, loving way. It works so harmoniously. It doesn't need anything, doesn't want anything. It just is. And as we let go and are at peace, and as we practice this peripheral vision program, we'll find that more avenues open up in our consciousness than we dreamed we were going after. Avenues of a brightness, of an awareness, of a clarity, of a peace, of a harmony. And then an added benefit comes along. We gain a sense of balance, and we can stand on one foot for a long time. And we can stand on one foot without rocking or leaning or bumping around. We just stand there, just lovely, just fantastic. I always remember the picture of this Somalian boy in the desert, and he was herding sheep. And he had no clothes, and he had no shoes, but he had his staff. And he was standing on one foot. And he was a very thin fellow, but he was standing on one foot. And he wasn't using his pole, his staff, to make him stand straight, but he had the staff across his shoulders. And he was standing on one foot, and he had the other foot on standing on his knee. And this was the way he stood. And I thought often over the years, as I had seen that picture, why did he stand on one foot, and why did he put one foot on his knee? And then the realization came to me. The desert sands are rather hot. And perhaps he was standing on one foot because that way both feet didn't have to get hot. But then, as years went on, and as I ended up speaking to tribes people from that country, where they stood on one foot and where they were doing things, I asked him, is the desert hot? Is it hot where you stand? And they said, what do you mean by that? Well, is it hot? Is it uncomfortable to stand on the desert? No, not at all. Well, why do you stand on one foot? Well, it's just a pose that we've gained. It's just something we do. It's just a comfortable way to stand. And how can you, when you stand like that, and then the next moment start running and run just like a gazelle and run so powerfully and so fast, how can you do that and with your bare feet across the desert? Well, that's all I know. I don't have shoes. I don't have anything to protect my feet. And so therefore, I run naked across the desert and I run like a gazelle because it's fun. Now, it's interesting that recently they have been doing some discoveries with the Eskimo dogs. And these Eskimo dogs are rather competent dogs, and they're rather capable dogs. And they run them across the desert, and as they run them across the desert, they ran them in periods of 8 hours, 6 to 8 hours, and they thought that these 6 to 8 hours was all that the dogs could take. And then one dog handler chose to have his dogs run across the desert on a 12-hour basis, 12 solid hours. And they thought, oh, that can't be done, that the dogs will burn out, their energy will be gone, they will not be able to handle that. And then they found that they could handle it quite easily, quite amazingly. And the reason that they could handle it quite amazingly, they haven't figured it out yet. But they took these dogs on trips, and they took them across the desert, they took them across the ice floe, and they fed the dogs as much as 12,000 calories. And the dogs were able to acclimate these 12,000 calories into their body, and they were able to do utterly marvelous things. And they could run, and they seemed to have more and more power in them, more and more strength in them to do their running. It was just amazing what they could do. And this is so contrary to what our science tells us, it's so contrary to what philosophy has told us, and so contrary to everything. Now, these dogs are running on frozen snow and ice. And as they're running on the frozen snow and ice, you would think that their feet would get cold. And as they eat this food, as they eat this amazing profundity of calories, and you'd think that their bodies would not be able to handle it or digest it or put it into motion for themselves. But they did that very readily and very easily. And now they're doing some tests on just those things because they're trying to figure out how these animals can do that. how they can possibly run like that. And it's utterly amazing to realize how it can be done. But it can be done. And the National Geographic had an item on it just in this particular issue here of March 2009. And it says here that the endurance test, sled dogs use more energy than other species, star athletes, but don't seem to feel the burn. The sled dogs burn 490 calories in this race. The daily energy burned in calories per pound, the man riding a bicycle, the cyclist in the Tour de France, 140 calories, and a horse in a three-day event of 45 calories. Rather amazing, rather fantastic. On March 7th, the 16 dog teams began 1,150-mile-plus distance at Iditarod race from Anchorage to Nome, Alaska. And for years, sled dog racers stuck to the basic long-distance formula of 6 hours on, 6 hours off. Recently, though, teams have won prominent races by going longer than was ever thought possible, up to 14 hours at a stretch, with the dogs getting stronger the longer they ran. Clearly a tactical rethink and a medical reevaluation were in order. Michael S. Davis at Oklahoma State University, veterinarian physiologist, says top dog sleds seem to flip a magic switch which somehow changes their metabolism after racing a few hours, that lets them quickly burn lots of calories, about 12,000 a day, from a fat-laden diet without depleting their muscles' fat and the sugar stores or growing tired. It's not quite clear just how they do it, or whether migratory animals have a similar capacity, but Davis hopes to find the hidden strategy, then see whether humans have one too. Musher John Little defends testing the endurance on sled dogs, typically huskies and malamutes, for the sake of science. They run because they love to run, he says, not because they have to. Might other breeds have the same metabolic switch? That's best answered by the racer who ran the four Iditarod tours with poodles. With poodles. Now, how about that? We have the capacity within us to do utterly amazing things if we would. And our capacity is something special indeed. Can we do this ourselves? Can we, by using the peripheral vision, increase our ability to be inward aware, to have balance? Can we perhaps find this magic switch that the dogs have that allow them to do amazing and wonderful things? And they do it because it's fun. All of life for us, for you and for me and for everybody, if we do it for fun, magic things happen. Well, let's know that these researchers are going to find out some interesting things about these dogs and their metabolic switches. And perhaps we'll find that that is really something to do with humanity and our own metabolic switches. Well, for today, have a lovely day, and know that in all things, I love you. I love you. I love you.